Today's podcast is sponsored by Casper, an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Go to casper.com/GOT and use promo code GOT, capital G, capital O, capital T, to save $50 off your purchase of a mattress.
Today's podcast is also sponsored by Sonos. For the first time ever, Sonos is offering the listeners of Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Use the promo code GOT10, capital G, capital O, capital T, 10, at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And we're back for one more wrap-up as Season 7 ends. I don't know exactly what we're going to talk about, but presumably we'll be talking about the season.
Oh, we have yet one more wrap-up, the spoiler edition.
Well, yeah.
That'll be coming out later.
Don't listen to that one.
Yeah. All right, well, you have to say at least 10 words. That's the contract quota. You have to say at least 10 words in a spoiler edition, or else you don't get paid.
Okay.
That's the deal.
That's the deal.
We signed 8,000 years ago. I have my armies amassed beyond the spoiler wall. I got my ice dragon. I'm just waiting for you to break it. Okay, so we talked about this in last week's spoiler edition, and it's nothing particularly spoilery about it, and I get dozens of emails, still getting dozens of emails about it. It's a theory about Bran is actually the Night's King.
Oh, they look so much alike.
Because there's lots of quote unquote evidence for this. There's the fact that they do dress similarly, which I think we've talked about before. The current state of the art theory appears to be that we've seen Bran Greensea back to the very beginning of the Night King, when he got turned into the warrior that we see today, with frosty crown upon his brow, armed to the teeth with white-making dragon missiles. And since Bran has seen that before, he's going... And since we also saw that Bran can warg into visions that he's seen in the past, such as Hodor, that he is going to attempt to break up this thing. He's like, oh, well, I'll just start it at the... I'll just nip it in the bud. And he'll attempt to warg into this, northern man who's being sacrificed by the children of the forest. And he'll turn into, and he'll try to stop it, but they won't listen to him, or he's gagged, or he, forgot all of any dozen.
This is sounding awfully fanfiction-y.
Any one of a dozen things that signals that this plan's a bad idea, and the children of the forest turn him into a White Walker anyway, and now his consciousness is trapped into the Night King for 8,000 some years, thus explaining their mysterious psychic connection.
I'm waiting for some evidence that...
I just gave it to you. Did you not hear all the evidence?
I heard evidence that it could happen.
Yeah.
I have not heard evidence that it will happen.
I'm just saying this is the latest whack. And the thing is, this does not mean that this is not exactly what is going to happen. I would not even be shocked to find out that there is some kind of thing like this as a twist. I don't think that Bran is literally going to be the Night King, but them having some kind of relationship, or the Three-Eyed Raven and the Night King having some kind of offsetting duty to the natural world like that, or Bran trying to do time traveling and turning the Mad King crazy. I have no doubt that Game of Thrones is big enough to have something like this as a twist. I just don't see the evidence, and I also just instinctively dislike any time where one of the heroes can pull his face back and it's actually the villain, or the villain can pull his face off and it's actually the hero.
Uh-huh.
That's what I think about this theory, and now we can stop talking about it for another season. I'm sure it'll come raging back in Season 8, but... Anything you want to include?
Yeah, can we talk for maybe a little bit about what we thought of the season after a week of distance from the finale?
Sure. I feel like I jumped the gun on the talk about the theory.
A little bit, I think.
Maybe
but
we should just start this all over. Go back to logo. All right.
We're good. We'll time travel back to before this and put it in.
You need to warp back in time to my body to prevent me from shooting my wad about the Night King theory. All right. What do you think?
I actually, so I've been thinking about it for a week or so, and I think this season is certainly not the strongest from a narrative perspective, from like a storytelling attention to detail sort of perspective. But I think the show has never been stronger from a spectacle angle, you know? And as we draw closer to the end of this show, it very much feels like that's what it has to become. I mean, they've been setting this up for seven seasons now. It's the final climactic battle between good and evil, between the dead and the living, that sort of thing. Yes, it's tropey, but that's fantasy, right?
Sure.
Like, there are only so many forces that people can come up with in this world, and at some point you have to put them opposing each other.
Yeah.
And that has to have a conclusion one way or another. And I don't know whether the Night King is going to win and all of humanity or whatever they're called in Westeros is going to be destroyed.
Right.
Or, you know, if quote-unquote good is going to triumph and the people will survive. But there has to be that battle. And I think the show has... I almost feel like last season they maybe should have been closing out some of the threads a little bit. Instead of opening so many more new ones, because it felt like going into this season, for me anyway, it didn't feel like we were going to say, all right, let's bring this thing to a close.
Right.
And I think maybe servicing that idea a little bit more last season might have helped this season not have to move at such a fast clip.
Or like the Alan Sepinwall theory is that you shouldn't give showrunners more than 1 year to finish things up because then they just do a lot of they just spend the whole time warming up and throat clearing and then the save the fireworks for next season. But that doesn't feel...
It doesn't feel like that's what they did here.
Fireworks were spared for this season.
None. That's what I mean. Like, they almost went a little too quickly in getting to the fireworks. But the fireworks were awesome.
Yeah. And I've seen there's so many polarizing views in this season. Like, you know, there's corners on Reddit where people are essentially saying this has turned into the third act of a Michael Bay movie.
This has turned into the third act of every story.
I want to unpack that a little bit because number one, if the first two acts of a Michael Bay film were the first six seasons of this Game of Thrones series, it's already better than your fucking average Michael Bay film. So the pyrotechnics to come are going to be grounded in presumably rich character motivations, and you're going to actually care about the fucking robots and the Decepticons and Autobots and the Dinobots and all the other shit. Like... The analogy disproves your kind of lack of interest in it just by stating it. The second is, now I'm going to go swing back the other way. I do think that even if this becomes the third act of a Michael Bay film, I would enjoy it more if I didn't have entire sections of the plot underpinned by giant asterisks. Like, this is awesome if you assume everything that the character's doing is not totally stupid, which it is. Yeah. Like, too much of this season had me, like, biting my tongue and being like, okay, well, this is objectively awesome, and I like how they resolved this, but the entire reason these people are here is stupid.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I like the way this character ended up here, but the way they behaved towards each other for the first three parts of this particular plot was big head-scratcher, didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I would love to go into episode or season 8 where we can just say, this is spectacle beyond anything we've ever seen, and it's all grounded in these people's, like, characterizations and dialogue and logic and plot that makes sense, and it's just objectively awesome. That's what I'm hoping for.
Sure, yeah. I do think they did some things that surprised me. Like, at the end of season 6, you've got this big rah-rah scene where Danny has teamed up with the Sand Snakes and teamed up with the Martells and the Tyrells and all the L's between.
Yep.
And she's sailing over to Westeros to presumably just kick ass and take over. And I like the way that they kind of pump the brakes on that. That's one of the plots that they did pump the brakes on.
Because
she could have just stormed in with dragons blazing and taken over Westeros, no problem. But it made a lot of sense for her not to do it, and they laid that case out pretty well.
I think that's that you're exactly right. And I totally agree. But it's indicative of the fandom that even then a lot of people are like, oh my god, Dragonstone is just a smaller version of Marine, you know, more landlocked version of Marine. Like,
but there's a lot of good reasons for it to be so. You know,
and there were in the book, like there's very good reasons for Danny to spend books and books and books and you know, episodes and episodes in Essos practicing being a queen, but like right. still did not make it any less frustrating when it looked like, okay, this is the season she's going to go over, and then there was a setback or something. Huh. So like I
never had those frustrations with it. No, I always felt like she's trying to accomplish her goal, and her goal is not just to destroy everyone and rule over a burnt landscape.
Right. I remember when I was watching season two, and when I was watching season two, I had read the first, I think, two books, maybe three, maybe I'd gotten all the way through, you know, A Clash of Kings and Storm of Swords, but I hadn't read Feast or Dance, and I read those between season two and three. And I remember in season two being very frustrated and impatient with Danny and her Where Are My Dragons bullshit and like how much foot dragging. And then I got to the books and like I was really frustrated with the stuff going on in Feast or Dance. And I remember reading this Myrinese blot blog that kind of like revealed underneath the frustrations the deeper political games were being played. And I got reinvested. But I kind of think that if I was just a show watcher, it would have gotten really tedious. Like, okay, I'm looking for Danny to go back and kick ass essentially after the end of season one, and I have to wait until season seven to see her actually make landfall.
Yeah.
I can see it being frustrating. And then when you think – you're right. That last episode of the season six with the dragons flying and this big convoy and Danny's at the head of this fleet of ships, like, yes. And then, like, you know, the brakes being pumped itself, I could see being frustrating.
Yeah. I suppose so. I guess I just didn't view it the same way as a lot of people did.
I want to say that I have come around on the Theon plotline, and a piece of feedback in large part helped me with that. Also, I watched Alt-Shift-X's video today, and I was already heading that direction. I think that, first of all, he's brilliant. He's got this deadpan delivery, so he, like, is able to point out all the good things and bad things, but he uses this exact same tone of voice, so it's like, I don't know, it's something to learn if you want to persuade people, because he just states these matter-of-fact things, and, like, you can't really disagree or agree with them. It's like, some people say this, and here's what I think, and I do it in this neutral British voice that you can't argue with. So talk about Theon, but also I really, really liked all the Winterfell stuff, which is highly controversial.
Huh. Okay.
So people are still wanting to ride or die for Littlefinger.
Littlefinger was a shit. He's always been a shit, and he deserved to die from day one.
Yeah.
What do you want?
Like, see, that's what's frustrating to me.
He's great to watch. He's so much fun to watch, but he's an ass.
That's what's frustrating to me is that they have been sowing the seeds of his destruction for the last three seasons now, ever since he kind of revealed his fixation with Sansa. And to me, like, a character has to be allowed some kind of imperfection or foible, or they're just like an completely unrelatable super force.
Yeah.
And, you know, Littlefinger was never a great warrior. He was always a great political schemer, and he's able to manipulate currencies and stock market fraud. Like, essentially, that's how he got powerful. And none of those things matter in the face of the Long Night and the populace starving and money no longer being something that's, you know, that's what the Hound story told, you know, that, like, he took this farmer and his daughter's small stash, like, well, they're going to starve anyway, and that's, like, everyone in the realm save, like, the lords and ladies, that's the fate they're looking at right now. So, like, Peter, like, he just ran out of rope, man.
Yeah.
And I don't think he could deal with the fact that, like, the person he was trying to scheme against now was also the person that he wanted to be in his little picture of his victory condition.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't need to see. Now, there is some surprise. Did you read any of the stuff that came out from, like, an interview with Isaac Hempstead Wright about, like, a scene that they had cut?
Huh.
We'll be talking about that in the feedback.
Okay.
But I thought that they told a pretty, like, and there's just if you stick with the stuff on the screen, there's like three different ways to interpret how Sansa and Arya and Bran came together. Like you could say like, well, Sansa figured out first, or Arya figured out first, or they all figured out at the same time, and they're all kind of supported by the screen. But I felt like all that stuff was there. And if you're going to be mad that there is theatrics involved in the demise of Littlefinger, then like you're just arguing against yourself. Like either he needs a fitting in with a little bit of showmanship to put it over the edge, or you know, I guess that's the thing. Like for the people that hated the Littlefinger plot, like how do you think Littlefinger should have gone out?
I mean, the thing that I so love about it is Littlefinger the whole way was giving Sansa the tools she needed to defeat him.
Yeah.
You know, he was, I think he was trying to groom her, in a certain manner of speaking, to be, like you said, in that picture of success that he saw. But she's not that type of person. And by handing her the tools that he uses, she's using them for good, right?
Right.
Like, not for self-gain.
Right.
And he just, I guess, expected to have more control over her and just failed.
And also, how does Littlefinger predict that he's going to come across Brandon Stark, who can see the past?
You can't, yeah.
Like, that's the other thing. Like, it's fine for people to be completely outmatched by some kind of change in the worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, the only thing that had been more satisfying, if Littlefinger had, before this episode, peaced out and tried to sneak out of Westeros under cover of darkness and, like, maybe tried to sneak out by the port of Eastwatch by the sea and got killed by the White's invasion.
Yep.
That would be the only thing more dramatically ironic. The thing that is the thing that gets him in the end,
mm-hmm.
just when he thinks he's safe. But, like, I don't, you know, getting your throat slit by Arya, not a bad way to go.
Yeah.
What else do we want to talk about?
I think that's about it.
It seems like there was a lot of noise and fury about Tyrion and his bedroom eyes. I feel like that battle's been fought over the internet, and people have come to the side of like Tyrion is not in love with Dany. He's just disturbed about the political ramifications of.
That's where I fell on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like, you know, that's another thing Alt Shift X did is he overlaid a lot of quotes for a lot of people being disturbed about, you know, like there's this, like Ser Barristan had some private ruminations about, you know, the thing that Rhaegar and Lyanna did by falling in love really fucked the realm.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, like they kind of, that was a very selfish move by them. And
started the war.
Tyrion,
right?
Who's an exquisite historian, mm-hmm. Or student of history, would see like, ooh, this could be, you know, I need Dany to make decisions as best for the realm. And can I trust her to do that if there's a decision that's good for the realm but bad for Jon Snow?
Right.
And that's a fair question to ask these young, attract ridiculously good-looking people that are in love.
Mm-hmm.
That's my general thoughts. Let's get to this. Someone asked us to rank the seasons. It was John S. John Snow.
Okay.
He laid out 4, 3, 1, 6, 2, 7, 5.
No, I don't agree with that. Season 2 I liked a lot.
Yeah, I did too. Like, so my ranking is, I think they're all approximately as good as one another. Now, it is jarring to see like the budget keeps jumping up each season. Like, mm-hmm. locations that you thought were awesome and looked great in season one, like Winterfell, like it looks a bit stagey in the film. The film cinematography is just not quite as good as mm-hmm. they continue to get better with this. But I think they're all approximately as good, with two being a minor drop off in quality because of Dany and her dragon bullshit. We're about to dive into that. Season 2 rewatch starts next week.
That's fair, but
and 5 and 7
Tyrion pulls that up a little bit.
You're right. You're right.
You know, he grabs it by the bootstraps, and
that is peak Tyrion.
Yeah.
And I think season 5 is noticeably off.
Yeah.
And season 7 is also noticeably off, but makes up for it by not being as, cuz here's the thing, like season 5 just had bad ideas, a lot of bad ideas and bad execution. I feel like season 7 had one whopper of a bad idea
mm-hmm.
that had middling execution, but then they finally brought some A-plus execution at the end.
Yeah.
But season 5, I think, is the worst season.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Just because they decided to make Jamie differ from Book Jamie, and that like Book Jamie's done with Cersei at the end of Dance with Dragons,
mm-hmm.
And in show Jamie decided to rekindle things with her, and that decision really seemed to fuck with what they were going to do with Jamie. Well, ascending to Dorne, that seems like a good idea. But you go down to Dorne, and Dorne's just ridiculous. And they never really had a plan to make, you know, like Dorne's machinations in the book happen. And, like, that was a wasted character.
It almost seemed like they spent too much time. So if they had gone with the book stuff, it would feel a lot better. But I think the way it turned out, it feels like they spent too much time introducing bad characters.
Yeah, and here's the thing I don't understand, because I always hear, like, even great successful showrunners, like I'm thinking Terrence Winters, I'm thinking Vince Gilligan, I'm thinking Matthew Weiner,
David Simon.
They don't. Well, he might be a notable exception.
Okay, I don't know where you're going with this.
I understand how, like, when you're first writing a pilot, you don't have all of the end game down.
Sure, yeah.
Like, not even thumbnail sketch, because you might not even be picked up. You might not even get out of second season. Mm-hmm. But, like, I feel like at some point at the end of season four, where they've had the Red Wedding, they've had the Purple Wedding, they've had the big plots in the books that they really were looking forward to nailing, why they wouldn't then, at that point, take a long off season and just, like, you know what? Let's get the arcs for let's at least outline the end of this series so we hit everything just right. And
I think they were expecting George to get there, to cross the finish line before they did.
You're late enough in the game that I think you're a little foolhardy there, but you know what I'm saying?
I don't
understand why they prefer to just come in every season with a clean slate. And I think a lot of 5 and 7, yes, ultimately to blame goes to George for not finishing the story, but a lot of 5 and 7 are the results of them making decisions that they couldn't get out of, and they had to roughly traverse a bunch of shitty Dornish terrain to get to where they wanted to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a hard time picking a favorite between 1, 3, 4, 6. They're really, I mean, this is a ridiculously good television show, people.
It is.
And, you know, I wish that it had been an adaptation straight through, but you know what? We don't get everything we want. Can we move on to feedback now? Or
yeah, let's do it.
Before we move on to the rest of the episode, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping. Of course, we've got one more Season 7 podcast, a spoiler podcast that comes out later this week. I've got an interview segment that we'll be talking with Kim Renfro, our buddy from The Insider, about our thoughts of the season and, like, theories and speculation without being contaminated by the leaks that we're going to be looking forward to. That's going to be fun. Season 2 coverage, retrospective coverage of Game of Thrones starts next week with the first episode of Season 2, where you'd think it would. Also, starting this week is Cecily and I's coverage of the American Horror Story Cult Season.
Yeah.
That's going to be fun. Mr. Stranger Things. Stranger Things, we're going to be doing a retrospective of Season 1 in the month of September.
Yeah, I'm excited for that.
Leading up to the Season 2 premiere, going to the, is it Upside Down or the Never Never, the Never Upside Down? Never Upside Down, not once. That's the name of the realm in Stranger Things.
Oh,
right?
It's the Upside Down, yeah.
Okay, the Dimmy Gorge.
The Dimmy Gorger.
We also are going to be returning with Mr. Robot and The Walking Dead coming back in October. And sprinkled throughout, you got Bald Move Television, Bald Movies, tons of club stuff. There's always something going on at baldmove.com. Don't think that you're off the hook just because Game of Thrones is dashing off into the sunset. Also, real quick, because I know we've had lots of other housekeeping and ads and stuff, but also don't forget about Club Bald Move. It's at club.baldmove.com. You get lots of bonus content. If you like what we do, it's a way to get our stuff faster, with more visual flair, and with less ads, and just straight-up bonus content. Lunch with Jim and Aaron, quips, video game playthroughs, all kinds of little interesting, unique. Plus, heading into holiday season, we always do an extravaganza for Christmas.
Yeah.
We do like a full month December. Television's slowing down, so let's just let our hair down and do some crazy crowd-pleasing stuff. It's a great time to join the club. It's a good gift that you can give, if you can figure out a way to give it. Is there a way to give it as a gift?
No.
We need to work up that campaign before Christmas.
Yeah, that's Christmas.
If you can't stock your stuffing with the club, then why am I even doing this? Club.baldmove.com. All right, Derek C., wanted a correction. I mentioned, you asked me on the spot where White Harbor was, and I said it was on the west coast of Westeros. I thought it was in Blazewater Bay. There's this, like, really sharp, daggery looking bay that cuts into the neck, and I thought sure that's where it was. Derek said that it's actually on the east coast of Westeros, just northeast of Moat Cailin. So that'd be a very quick and easy sail from King's Landing.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have to go around the entire continent like I supposed.
Also makes sense. That's why it'd be a prosperous port, because it's the main, it's the thing that connects all the luxuries of the South through the austerity of the North. So yeah, big fuck up by me there. Adam M, how would you feel if Game of Thrones took one of their final episodes and devoted entirely to the White Walkers through time, a la Lost's Across the Sea episode about Jacob and the Man in Black?
Whew.
Given that you guys have brought up a few times that you'd like to see the White Walker's background to make them an interesting villain, would devoting an entire episode be something you'd prefer, or would it ultimately be a waste because of the inevitable backlash it would get due to stealing scene time from a character as we've known, come to know and love and hate?
If we had two more seasons left, maybe I'd say, okay, go for it. But with six episodes, to take 1/6 of the season and devote it entirely to the backstory of some characters that we really just need sketches of.
Right.
I don't know that we need to actually fill in all the details about the White Walkers.
Right.
I'd be okay with just understanding a little bit more about them, which you could do with a few scenes interspersed through several episodes.
So I'm going to steal an idea from another show we've done, The Walking Dead. You remember the debacle when they went back and like did the governor's backstory? Mm-hmm. Had like a 3-episode governor arc that nobody wanted.
Yeah.
We had talked about, like, would that have been better if that was a series of, like, 10-minute cold openings?
Yeah.
That, like, they told his backstory juxtaposed with the current events, and it all came together to some kind of climax.
That's the key. It has to come together.
I'm thinking, like, what if they did, like, a 10-minute cold open about the Night King's history that opened up every one of the 6 episodes that we're going to get, and then they're essentially, it's kind of a little bit the film Memento, where you've got one narrative running this way and the other narrative, and they collide in the final in some kind of
To teach us
satisfying
something about ourselves,
the essential,
or give
tragedy
us some insight into humanity. Yeah.
Right. Like, I could see that working.
Yeah, sure.
Because they got it, like, you know, this goes to, like, you know, me wanting to avoid these giant asterisks of, well, this is awesome, but, like, you know, the ultimate asterisk is if George just cops out and makes the Night King be this implacable, totally evil, non-rational actor that the villains, that the heroes have to overcome. That's not very Game of Thrones.
It's the Lord of Rings thing that he said he didn't want to do.
Now, it could be that it turns out that this is a sideshow, and that the meat is going to be the combined armies of the living confronting the corrupt Lannisters, who are now, I mean, you know, that's the other thing that All Shift X's video made it clear to me, is like everyone we care about or give a shit about or is important to the plot is in the North, with the exception of Cersei, Qyburn, the Mountain, and Euron. So, like,
okay, loosely defining the word care about.
but you know, the have to have, like, the,
yeah,
these people
yeah,
have
yeah.
to have ends.
They're important.
They're important to the plot.
To the plot, yeah.
So, like, it really shows that, you know, that I guess that's the. That's the counterpart to the argument. If the real story is going to be the defeat of Cersei, it seems like, I mean, maybe this Golden Company is going to be a little bit of, like, you know, making it a game, you know, making it a good game, because now Cersei's got this injection of fresh. But I'm really starting to think that it's not going to be likely that Euron comes back with the Golden Company and helps Cersei out. Like, what does he need? What does Cersei give him at all now? It went from she's got the army, I got the navy, and she's got the money, to now I've got the navy, I've got the army, I've got all of her money. All she's got is a swollen stomach and a dark castle. So fuck all that noise.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I think a whole 90-minute episode about the Night King and his pathos and the teenage years and his bad poetry, that's a bit much, but maybe they can do something cool.
Yeah.
Tiffany V, hey, I keep hearing you guys say that we aren't getting the last Game of Thrones season for another year and a half, that we have to wait until 2019. Where is your source for this? I can't find anything that is actually stating that. Most of what I see says late 2018, maybe early 2019. Thanks, guys. I mean, you're reading the same source as I am. Here's how the logic goes. In the last 3 seasons, it's taken somewhere between 9 months and 11 months to turn around the series from the time filming begins to the episodes airing. All right. Now, the other thing that I kind of blew my mind when I was researching the answer to this is since mid-July, it's been known that the scripts for season 8 are done.
And they're turned in, and they're actually just blocking it out. And it's that like in late July, early August, they were actually blocking the scenes to give to directors to, you know, so they can go out location and start filming. There's an interview with Nikolai Coster-Waldau that says that he was planning to go back to work in October, which is also like, I guess it's like a 68-week window between the actors getting their scripts and going to work in October, which means scripts could start leaking as early as like tomorrow, essentially, because like the first actors are probably going to be getting like the Peter Dinklages and the Kit Harringtons and the Emilia Clarks of the world are going to start getting their scripts very soon. Mm-hmm. So if you take that math, the 9 to 11 month math, the beginning of filming in October, that gives you a July 2018 to September 2018 timeline. But the other rumor is they're flirting with making all these episodes feature length, right, which they've never done before. And also the interviews say that there's just a truly preposterous amount of VFX in these final episodes.
I bet. Yeah.
So that, like, you start getting to where if you don't hit October, no one releases, like, Game of Thrones is not going to be released in November.
No.
Like, there is a dead zone from beginning of November to essentially mid to late January where you will not, it's just like HBO is not going to release anything.
Like, new series. They typically try and place it so that nothing is airing over Christmas.
Right.
Because people don't watch TV as much during Christmas.
Yeah, it just throws a big monkey wrench into it. So. Yeah. It could, like, I could see it coming back. Like, it could come out next summer. It could. But there's just a lot of, like, people hinging their bets and saying, I wouldn't count on it. I'm thinking that, like, it's more late. And if it goes late, then the later it gets, the more HBO is just going to push it to next year.
That's the thing. When you say early 2019, that is a year and a half.
Right.
Roughly from now.
Right. But if it comes out in July, like if like the best estimates come true.
Well, I mean the emailer said late 2018, early 2019 is what she's hearing, right? So
right.
That is a year and a half. That is a little bit longer than.
And here's another meta. Like so far, Westworld is slated to go into that like season one True Detective late winter slot.
Mm-hmm.
So now you start putting your meta hat on. No fucking way. Game of Thrones is going to be scheduled on Sunday night with Westworld.
No.
So if Game of Thrones slips into 2019, it could be like back into its old slot of spring.
No, boy.
You know, yeah, you're looking at like April. Because that's the thing. If it either comes out in 2018, like late summer, early fall, or it's not going to come out till the spring. Unless they bump Westworld, which why the hell would they do that? Westworld's a massive show, too.
Or Westworld takes longer. I don't know. I
mean, yeah.
That's the thing about Westworld. It's also moving.
I've heard good things about it, though.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. It's like, I don't have an inside source. This is just me synthesizing, and I'm a pessimist. I'm a cynic. I prepare for the worst, and I occasionally get pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Much better than always hoping for the best and constantly being disappointed. Kyle J. Although you tend to steer clear of contemporary geopolitical comparisons in Game of Thrones, one that both the show and books could well be an excellent metaphor for is the climate change and the public political will to do anything about it. While Vox did an excellent cross-comparison of the following following the conclusion of Season 5, the collation has only grown stronger as the emphasis on the Night King and the coming threat beyond the Wall has increased, along with the character's awareness and acceptance of the reality of this threat. While I have previously commented on the stupidity of the plan to capture the White to prove to Cersei the reality of this threat, as you predicted, she didn't care. The contemporary comparison I see is that even with more than 97% of our contemporary maesters/scientists stating that climate change is real and the threat is real, in addition to the long-term consequences of an action, yet though they have provided proof and moreover prudent steps that could be taken to address this global threat, many of our political leaders continue to insist that climate change isn't real.
Bill Nye has got a plan to go north and get part of an iceberg and bring it south. I think it's a stupid plan because icebergs melt down
here
anyway, but yeah. He seems to think it's a good idea.
What if he gets an ice dragon to fly it back super fast?
Then yes.
And to breathe ice fire on it so it keeps it cold. They're refrigerated.
Okay. I'd be convinced.
Ice white, if you would. They are intent on ignoring it and moreover willing to align with short-term gains over long-term human sustainability and ultimately survival, again, not unlike Cersei. Hence why the Night King, White Walkers, and Army Dead is the ultimate threat to the people of Westeros. Regardless of house, so too is climate change the ultimate threat of the people of Earth, regardless of nation. For both cases, time is not on our side.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right. And also George Martin endorses this view of his works. Like, it's not, he did not contemporaneously sit down in the mid 90s to write a cautionary tale about global warming. It's more of humanity's inability to confront common threats in any kind of scale to matter. So, that means like this could be, you could substitute this to be, if mankind, what can mankind do about the threat of acid rain? What can mankind do about the threat of the ozone layer? What can, like, the, I'm throwing out like climate disasters in my lifetime that I've seen humanity accept. And but the thing that's different about this, that, and like global warming is, it is bizarre to me to see the lengths at which people will go to deny it. Like, there, back when there was a hole in the ozone layer, there wasn't, like, I don't, maybe the hairspray industry just wasn't strong enough, but people weren't being like, we need more research to see if this hairspray is actually eating the ozone. It's like, oh, shit, Australia's fucked. We got to stop this. Uh-huh. Same thing with acid rain. Like, you know, 400-year-old statues are being melted in Rome. What the fuck are we doing? Like, we got to fucking scrub these coal stacks and shit. And, like, I don't get it.
Yeah,
I do guarantee that I will get dozens of hate mail messages for reading this shit, and you know, a bunch of people swear off to listen to our show. So, and so it goes. Zach T from Canada. Everyone agrees that the plan to capture a white is stupid, but at least the people who came up with that plan are human and fallible. But we're also meant to believe that the Lord of Light deity also thought this plan was a good idea, since he provided the vision which sent the Hound, the Bear, and the Thurs to join the plan.
Here we go. Are you going to try and tell us what the Lord of Light's plan is?
This is either God is all-powerful, all-knowing, or all-loving. Pick one. Checkmate, Christian. No.
No, it's just like, okay, this may be part of a larger plan. Like, we don't know the motivations of the Lord of Light.
So that's what he's asking. It's like, which of these three of his possibilities do you subscribe to, Jim? The Lord of Light is equally as dumb as John Tyrion / Danny. He sent him there to protect the other fools venturing north of the wall. Or could the Lord of Light maybe be working with the bad guys? Are the Lord of Light and the Night's King two sides of the same coin, both working towards the same still unknown end?
Man, I put a giant question mark over this whole thing because we don't know. It's not like I can guess what the Lord of Light wants and how he's going to get there.
Right.
Like, even if I knew what he wanted, I can't guess how he's going to direct events to get there, because he could be setting up chess pieces that I can't even fucking see, let alone know how they're going to move. So, question mark. I don't fucking know.
I mean, I think the fact that this Lord of the Light would be as stupid as our main characters, you can dismiss that. And also, I guess I would dismiss... I mean, I'm a little more open to the Lord of Light actually being the other side of the Great Other, because that's kind of like a yin and yang, dark and light side. That's a fantasy concept that is well-worn and kind of tropey. To the extent that, like, if Martin just straight up does it like that, like, it doesn't seem to do much of his advancing the state of fantasy art, which is kind of what he consciously set out to do with Game of Thrones. Like, Song of Ice and Fire. Tolkien did the definitive high fantasy adventure. I want to now add a little bit of realism and modernism to it and subvert all these tropes. So it's probably going to be more the third option, but is it going to be, like, you know, literally the light and dark side of the Force? Or is it going to be something more interesting than that?
Yeah, because it seems like that's been done.
Or, you know, like, I keep coming back to, like, some possibility where there is a magical force that is not animate and is not intelligent. It's expressed by the people who wield it for either good or evil.
Right.
So then you look at the human agents, like... You gotta ask yourself, is the Night King evil? Is Bran evil? Is Melisandre evil? Is Miri Mazdur, the witch that killed Drogo, is she evil? Like, those are the questions that are interesting to ask, because they're all using the same, roughly same energy field or whatever.
Possibly.
That's where I'm thinking it might go down, but again, like Jim says, it's a big question mark. Brian C., I watched the finale again and had some thoughts about Tyrion. I've not completed the books, but here are some of my thoughts. His character's been great because he's witty, perceptive, and smart. That said, his last piece of strategic Our truly great strategic work was at the Battle of the Blackwater.
Which is why I love that season so much, yeah.
Yeah. Now, and see, and he, that's why you the book's easy, it's even better. Like, yeah? I mean, that's, like, he actually has a couple more tricks that he plays in the Battle of Blackwater that are pretty mind-blowing. Now, in the season finale, he's completely played by Cersei, including the one-on-one where she purposely signals to Tyrion her pregnancy. So unless I'm mistaken, his value add as Daenerys' hand has been lacking for some time. I also understand that Tyrion is cited as Gurm's favorite character when he's asked during Q&As at conventions. But why? Beyond his cleverness, is it because of his flashes of brilliance combined with humanity to make mistakes? He wants us to take the measure of Tyrion's character at this stage and think whether this perspective on his character matches our thoughts of his character arc and our expectations, or whether the double Ds have mishandled him.
I certainly think early on, like even beyond season two, that he, I mean, he is very smart. He's very witty. He's very charming. Mm-hmm. He does have a fairly good strategic mind. Mm-hmm. I just think he has gotten out of his depth a little bit,
right?
In this last season, and I'm not actually sure why. I think it's because he's blinded a little bit by, you know, his feelings about his family, but
right.
I'm not certain of that. Like, right. I don't know that the show did put like such a firm stamp on it.
Right.
Last season.
I think this might be another place where the double Ds are left bereft of a roadmap that they could really use, because at the end of Dance, Tyrion is still just now coming out of his drunken woe is me. George Martin's got to show me the depths of the to which a character can sink to before he can continue his arc kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's tough to there. I guess what I'd say is the double Ds are trying to triangulate, you know, a couple of triumphant Tyrion bullet points from the, you know, kind of low and debauched and depressed state that Tyrion's in the books, and trying their best, but
they're all getting just essentially trampled over by Jaime. Well, and I wonder if that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah,
is set up the idea that, you know, Tyrion fancies himself as a very intelligent, very clever person, right. But Jaime's been through a lot of shit,
right.
And Jaime's been on the battlefield, and he knows how these things work, and
right.
He's actually better at it than Tyrion is, though Tyrion thinks he himself is better.
Right. Well, it's also, there's like this thing about like smart people, even very smart people tend to fight the last battle. Like, you know, you get the military leaders that came out of the last war, and they're the best at killing and avoiding being killed. And like in the 40s and 50s, they're like, oh, the next war is probably going to be fought with tank battles against threat of nuclear war on the plains of Europe.
Right.
And then they get embroiled in a series of low-intensity conflicts in the jungles, deserts, and mountains of the world, and like, fuck,
yeah.
What do we do with all these Abrams? And, you know, like, these no longer fit the kinds of missions. And I think there's a little bit of Tyrion is trying desperately to avoid political situations that he himself lived through and saw his kind of rip apart his family.
Yeah.
And is kind of caught flat-footed in a new world where, you know, you have to maybe risk everything to do to save humanity, because that's what the stakes are. And he's reluctant to do that because he's seen that blow up in people's faces. So,
I mean, as far as his character, yeah, I can certainly see why you would criticize him and say maybe he's not as smart and as strategically clever as he thinks he is. But I feel like I know why George Martin is, like, he says Tyrion's his favorite character.
Right.
It's probably the most fun to write for.
Right.
I have to imagine. He's got the best language. He's got the best scenarios. Like,
characters
he's
that don't
doing
give
all the
a
fun
fuck.
Stuff.
Characters that don't give a fuck are the best. And Tyrion, you know, can't afford to give a fuck, or he would be paralyzed. So, like, yeah, no, he gets all the best snark, you know, but he's also, you know, he's got all these natural limitations and frustrations that make him approachable and human.
Yeah.
You know, if he was in Jaime's body, he'd probably be an insufferable prick.
And fun to write for, right?
It adds
texture to his character,
right.
That able-bodied, or I mean, not even able-bodied. He's able-bodied. He's just got a smaller body.
Right.
That I guess characters without his disadvantages don't have, you know?
All right. So I think we talked enough about Tyrion. Let's move on to John H.M., Should we be concerned that Sansa did not swing the executioner's sword on Littlefinger after passing the sentence? I'm not sure if the younger Starks got that lesson from Ned, including the girls, but does this even matter?
They took a lot of lessons from Ned, and that wasn't one of them, apparently.
You know, it's interesting because I think that's a fair point, because Ned put a lot of, like, you know, the man who passes the sentence should swing the sword. You should not be, like, I don't believe in headsmen, because you shouldn't be spared the consequences of your decisions.
Yeah.
And that gets thorny when you're talking about, you know, essentially his little girl sitting on the throne, because, you know, there's the unspoken, like, patriarchy that underpins this whole world. The fact that, like, Ned would never expect his daughters to swing swords, pass sentences, or do any of that shit.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's interesting that, like, I wonder if they're trying to get at the fact that, first of all, do the Double D's even care? Like, there's very little evidence that they're sweating this, like, oh, God, wait a second. We just had someone give a sentence and they didn't swing a sword. This is a violation of Stark prime directive. What the hell? Like, I don't even think they're thinking of that. But
that's a shame.
If they are, is it possible they're suggesting that they got, like, a little Stark Voltron situation going here?
Like that, the Starks are one unit.
Yeah, because if I know anything about literary artists, they love this shit. Like this, their Christ imagery and their Trinity figures, and the fact that like Arya, Sansa, and Bran, even though very limited and unable to be Ned and Ned's role in society, if they came together, you know, like Sansa, like Arya is literally Sansa's sword. And, you know, Bran is Ned's wisdom and his centeredness and groundedness and self, and, like, you know, this, and Sansa's the one that coordinates all this. I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Sansa's the black lion in this situation. I don't know how well that sits with me, but
I mean, it works with the theme, you know, that lone wolf versus the pack theme they've got going. I guess that does work. And it could from a certain point of view.
There are no obvious alpha wolves here,
yeah.
Which, by the way, is a discredited animal theory anyway. But there's no obvious alpha wolves here, but so the pack has to come together and wear the different hats that they need to survive. Yeah, I like that idea. But I guess I'm not too worried about Sansa. I guess the real question is, is the show trying to tell us something that Sansa done fucked up because she didn't swing the sword? I don't think the answer is yes.
I don't think so either.
Andrew O., where do you guys think that John and Danny's story should go and how it should end? I still think they should both survive the series, and I think there's four major options. Danny dies in childbirth like her mother and John's mother, and John looks after the baby. John dies and Danny lives to have their baby, and they rule Westeros together. They both live and rule the Seven Kingdoms, or decide family is more important than ruling and decide to live on Dragonstone. That's a distinct 3A and 3B, sir. I think you now have five options. They both die and the baby's looked after by the Starks. Or five, they both die and Cersei's baby sits on the throne, or one of them lives and babysits Cersei's baby, and there's 2.5 men. Do you have any idea, like, okay, let me ask you this. Do you think John and Danny have any chance of surviving this?
Both of them?
Yes.
Yeah, I think they have a chance.
Wow.
I don't think it's a very good one.
Okay.
But I don't think there's no way they both survive, you know? Like, does one of them have to die? No.
See, I think, to me, when I think of, like, George Martin's frequent commentary that the ending of The Song of Ice and Fire will be bittersweet, that implies that somebody gonna have to die. So the others may live, and that's the bittersweet part of it. Or it could be that, you know, I guess I've always believed there's just no way Danny and John can both survive this series. That's my bias, because to me that's just an unabashed happy ending. Like,
I don't know. I mean, we could lose Tyrion. We could lose,
but how does Tyrion dying would be a bummer, but it doesn't. I don't think it adds bitterness nor sweetness to the ending.
I think it would be bitter for me. I don't want Tyrion to be killed at the end of this.
Huh. I never thought of it that way. To me, I always view bittersweet as I guess who's sitting on the Iron Throne, if there is an Iron Throne, and what sacrifice it has to make to get there.
I mean, what if I mean, Winterfell is destroyed, and Sansa and Arya and Bran are killed.
Or Arya sacrifices herself to save Jon and Jon and Dany. So I guess that, because Jon, I mean, that's the thing. That's the one meetup we haven't seen, the Jon and Arya one. Because, you know, they were, they had a special kind of connection as the black sheep of their family.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really looking forward to that, and I didn't get to this year. So, I mean, maybe that would be bittersweet.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you're probably right. The chances are it's more likely that one of them is going to die than they both survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, a lot of the story has been telling us that. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think it has to happen, but I think it's likely one of them is dead.
I also think it's unlikely that both of them die, but maybe especially if we're going to this democracy thing, which, by the way, there was
a himself for it
over on r/ASIOAF, whatever it is, a Song of Ice and Fire subreddit. There was a lot of angry threads about, like, denouncing the idea that there'd be some form of democracy in Westeros at the end of this. And I just want to chime in. And, like, most of these people were being fucking stupid and essentially, like, there'll be a U.S.-style democracy.
With a constitution.
No, you dumb fucks. That's like, Jesus fucking Christ. Someone go back and tell the Greeks that they were doing democracy wrong. Right. Or the Roman Republic. There's so many different types of democracy you can have. Uh-huh. And there's historical evolutionary baby steps towards, like, the full representational democracy that we kind of sort of have in this country, and they have it in various other countries and different configurations around the world. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But I think I also think you're being super stupid by thinking there's going to be an Iron Throne at the end of all this. But, you know, whatever. I guess we could just hate each other forever.
That's the
bittersweet end. That's the bittersweet ending. The bitter divisions between the legions of Double D and Germ fans are going to fight tirelessly when this is all said and done.
Probably.
Okay. Dana Kay, we talked about this in the spoiler edition, but I know a lot of people don't listen to that, so I want to talk about it in this one, too. She says, Dana Kay said, I didn't write in to correct it because I thought a lot of other people would, but you said on multiple occasions now, in A Dance with Dragons, this is the text. She's talking about Dany's bleeding or lack thereof. She was bleeding, but it was only her woman's blood. The moon is still a crescent, though. How can that be? She tried to remember the last time she had bled. The last full moon, the one before that?
The one before that?
It cannot have been so long as that. I am the blood of the dragon, she told the grass aloud. Apropos of nothing.
I'm the dragon, you fucking
grass. As I'm bleeding
grass.
On you.
Remember that?
So Dana says,
or I'm coming back for you.
It sounds like she missed a period or two. That's why so many have speculated, probably rightly, that she's at this point having a miscarriage, which that's kind of interesting itself. But yeah, I assume that she was just all shut down there, and Dana has set me straight, so... I guess it is possible that the infertility thing has just been all in her head the whole time. Although Dany has a lot of sex in both the series and the books.
It's true.
Completely unprotected because they didn't roll that way in Westeros, and she hasn't been drinking moon tea. So, I mean, that's kind of evidence that a young woman having a bunch of sex doesn't get pregnant. The Valyrians had the rhythm system. It was Valyrian steel and the rhythm system that were lost in the Doom of Valyria.
Daario doesn't strike me as a pull-out kind of guy.
No, he is not. He's not the pull-out king.
Nope.
Patrick Yu, questions. Or question, do you think the Double D's listen to your podcast? Answer, no. Moving on.
Definitely not.
They actually, so he has a couple questions about, like, you know, since we are one of the larger Game of Thrones podcasts and they run this giant multi-million dollar enterprise, they have to get fan feedback somehow.
Reddit.
Yeah, I mean, that's
Reddit's the best place for it.
Now, I will say that I've been shocked because I have talked to people involved in the filmmaking process, and I found out that, like, Matthew Weiner of Mad Men fame was aware of some of the theorizations and jokes of our podcast. And
yeah, we had, like, someone close to him on the production.
Yeah. One of the editors
listened to it. Yeah.
And then we had, when we interviewed one of the writer producers, executive director or producers of Justified, they mentioned that they listened to some of but I think what happens is, you know, the kind of below the line people will listen to the podcast, and that stuff kind of fit, like, the jokes and, like, the positive stuff and maybe something that kind of filters through to consciousness, because I don't see how the Double D's or anybody at their level of production can ever go, like, to the primary sources.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'd say Reddit is the best, but I feel like Reddit's the best for fans, because, like, if I'm a creator and I go to Reddit, I'm like, just overwhelmed by the polarization of it all, like the vicious fighting on both sides of it.
Yeah.
And that could really bring me down. I feel like if I'm a creator, what I want to do is go to the critics. And I want to read, like, the people who are going to take this stuff professionally and are going to talk about it in a measured way.
Yeah.
And who are not going to just try to sell their point of view with the most colorfully hateful language they can.
Right. And also, that's a great way to get fan feedback, because you know who interfaces with the critics? The fans.
Right.
And a lot of times that back and forth leaks into their writing on it, and they'll mention. So, like, there's no need to go to, like, a fan community or a podcast or something when you can. I mean, hell, you can have an executive assistant that just, hey, read through the front page of Reddit on Monday, give me the bullet points of what people liked and didn't like. And the other thing is, I think a lot of creatives don't want that feedback.
Mm-hmm.
They part of their creative process is coming up with this in a vacuum, and they don't want to have this, like, writing by committee going on.
That's fine, yeah. It can leave you blind to the things that are wrong with your own show.
Yeah, but also it allows you to do things that are, like, truly great and out of the box.
Yeah.
Because it's not just some consensus. And also, man, like, if just 10% of the people on Reddit are morons, you're going to 1 out of 10 posts is going to be from some moron. Like, there's some bad ideas that are highly upvoted on Reddit every day.
Yeah.
Like, your worst nightmare would be a season 8 written by the consensus of r/ Game of Thrones and r/ ASIOAF.
It would.
WXYZ. Like, it would be terrible. So let's all keep that in mind as we're piling on the double Ds.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Paul S. My name is Eddie, and I have a question for the Game of Thrones podcast. Well, you're in the right place, Paul. Although, why is your name Paul S. if your name's Eddie? What the fuck?
You just outed him.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
All right, Eddie, let's try to get through this together. Let's see if we can kind of find a bittersweet end to this email. Any thoughts as to why Jaime Lannister did not take the Lannister army with him at the end of the last season? He is the head of the Lannister house and army, so it made sense that he would have taken what was his when he left. Treating like a divorce with Jaime saying, I'm taking the army with me and you can use your sellswords. Historical leaders of armies have taken advantage of the loyalty of troops that have for them for their own gain. Yeah, I just got done listening to a 6-hour... Dan Carlin podcast. It's all about Julius Caesar doing that.
Right.
I
think if he tries, he's like, I'm leaving.
Right.
Are you going to have the mountain cut me down? Oh, and also I'm taking your armies with me.
Yeah.
She probably does cut him down.
And it's also a big question about whether the generals, I guess, of the Lannister army would, if the queen was saying, like, I want you to do this, and he was saying, I want to do that, how many would go with him?
Yeah, I...
Because the other thing is, like, think of Jaime's reputation in Westeros and, you know, the fact that, like, you know, the rumors around him and his sister and the fact that he doesn't have his hand anymore and that he was the betrayer. Like, does he have the kind of reputation, the Julius Caesar-like political ability to use that? I don't know.
Also, I don't think that the moment we see Jaime ride out of King's Landing is the moment that Jaime leaves King's Landing forever. A, he's got nothing on him. He's wearing his fucking armor. He has no food. He has no water. He has nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going out there to collect his thoughts. Like, he's very much on this train of, I'm leaving and I'm done with this shit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this is, like, the finality of it, right? I mean, he would take something with him. Where's he going? What's he going to do?
See, I thought that was like this. I always thought that the way he was dressed at the end of this season is him metaphorically taking the black and going north.
Mm-hmm.
Although, so to the extent that I haven't thought about any of this shit, I wonder, you know, because some people wrote in and be like, hey, what about the Dorne's army? Do you think one of the reasons they had Jaime going south is so he'd be familiar with Dorne's culture and that he could maybe go and rally the troops down there?
That's possible.
I don't think it's very possible.
No.
I think I'm making shit up and putting it out there and seeing what people think of it.
I mean, it's possible. I didn't say it was probable.
Yeah. No, I think he's just going to go essentially by himself. Because you're right. Like, if he took all the Lannister armies, I think that Cersei sends the mountain and whatever troops she has loyal, the gold cloaks and whatever troops she has loyal in the Golden Company to the and find Jaime and destroy him. And I think Jaime knows that. Like, he walked out of King's Landing with his life, and that was just barely.
Yeah.
So he knew not to push his luck. Now, is that sad? Because But Jamie's not Julius Caesar. That's the thing. Like, I don't think you can plug him in and say he would command. Like, he's not a George Washington type. He's not a Julius Caesar type. He's not
Fucking
Alexander.
Think of his reputation.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. He's the Kingslayer.
Right. He's an oathbreaker. He's
sleeping with his sister because that's an open secret in the court and everyone kind of knows about it and makes japes behind his back. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's I don't know that he has that kind of military clout.
Maybe not.
Josh B, this is a good question. Do you guys have any idea why no character has so much as mentioned Wildfire? It seems to me the most obvious and viable weapon against the Night Army. Is it off the table and I missed it? If not, John clearly articulated the two ways to kill whites. Dragonglass, which at best kills one at a time, must be deployed by people whom you risk adding to the White Army, and also fire. This is a bit strange to me, considering the Wildfire has already been used twice to handily destroy seemingly insurmountable threats, both efforts of which were orchestrated by characters who are still alive, in power, and knowledgeable about the whites and their weaknesses. Do we have an explanation towards why anyone, particularly Tyrion, is neglecting the billion of pots of white begone under King's Landing? Or if there aren't any pots left, why every single capable human is not working 24/7 to make more? That's a damn good question.
Okay, here's... I will admit that maybe Tyrion should have mentioned it. However, where is Tyrion going to get Wildfire from? He doesn't know how to make it. He doesn't know anybody who knows how to make it aside from the people at King's Landing who are under Cersei's control. If they're going to march into King's Landing to get Wildfire, they're marching to take King's Landing.
You're right. There is a class of people known as pyromancers that were introduced in Season 2 that know how to make Wildfire.
Right.
I don't think they're the only people on Earth that do. Maybe you'd have to go over to Essos someplace to get it, but the fact that it isn't mentioned does bother me, because that would have been...
He should mention it.
Because there was a little bit of missing horse trading going on, you know, like, I mentioned this on the show that, like, I thought it kind of rubbed me the wrong way that John and Danny's right up and be like, hey, here's the deal, we got a ceasefire, it's going to last long enough for us to take care of this threat north, and we're going to come back and unitedly kick your ass. Like, there's... nothing that there's no real bone that they're dangling in front of Cersei, and if they had some, like, this is part of the parlay, like, you actually could be a valuable cog, and you know King's Landing has a secret to making Wildfire, you might have a trove of it, blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of bothers me that it's not even part of the plot.
I think probably the Maesters would know how to make it. Yeah. I assume.
Yeah. Maybe one thing if it's like Valyrian steel where just no one knew how to make it. But yeah, why wouldn't the Maesters have like detailed files on that kind of thing?
They probably do.
Yeah.
I imagine, yeah.
But no one, you know, that's something that's...
Maybe Sam, one of those books is Wildfire.
Sure.
Sam's going to have the Dothraki, 100,000 Dothraki making Wildfire next season.
Yeah, and little clay pots.
that's just a recipe for disaster. That's like having a meth lab in your kitchen.
Yeah, or having a bunch of 3-year-olds making gunpowder.
Yeah.
You're just asking for something to go. Like, these people have no technology. They worship a dragon woman,
right.
And you're wanting to make highly, like, TNT. Good luck. I wish that was a bit... I wish that was a... something that they would mention, because it's, you know, on the other hand, I will say that I never even thought of it till Josh B wrote in, so maybe it's one of those things where they're just hoping we don't notice.
They could get the same magician who's making Danny's clothes to make some Wildfire.
right Take the guy that's outfitting her in her winter expedition attire.
He is meticulous.
He is Before we get to feedback, I want to talk about today's sponsors, one of whom is Casper. Now, Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price, and I've been sleeping on a Casper for some years now, since, I want to say season 4 is when we got that. And when the box came, I was shocked, because, not just at the fair price, but at the packaging, because, like, this is a king-size mattress that they fit into a box that's roughly like if you took Tyrion Lannister and you boxed him up for safe shipping. That's like that's exactly how big.
Maybe we should ask Varys how big this mattress is.
It's not even
Varys,
like,
should be doing this.
It's not like even Warlock for Essos like box. Like, that's like a quarter of the size of Varys's box, and it came with its own little special tool. You slice it open, it flops out, and bam, it's a full size mattress.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a unique blend of foam layers for an ideal firmless. It's got just firmless.
Firmless?
Firmless?
Is it firmless?
It's firmlessness.
I don't want a firmless mattress. I hope it's not firmless.
Well, how do you know? Because firmless is not a real word. It's actually ideal firmness. It has just the right sink and just the right bounce. I like that. I like that. Also, I like the whatever blend they use has a really good like thermal conductivity. I never feel like I'm freezing or I'm burning up. Like it's been super hot and we sleep in a loft at home. Yeah. So like that's super important for me and it's never let me down so far. It's affordable because they sell direct to consumers. There's no middleman. There's free shipping returns to the U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You get to try it for 100 nights free and no hassle return if not happy.
Yeah, I mean, that's as risk-free as possible, right? Yeah, 100 nights on this mattress and it's free shipping back if you don't like it.
Go to a mattress company and tell them you're going to take their mattress home and you're going to sleep on it for 99 nights and then ask them to pick it up if you're not satisfied. You will be laughed out of their brick-and-mortar store. You know who won't laugh at you? Casper.
Yeah.
Casper, like, try that. That's confidence. It's designed, developed, and assembled in the USA. If you want to take advantage of this offer, it's easy. Go to casper.com/GOT and use the promo code GOT. You got to do them both. You got to use the URL /GOT and use the GOT code to save $50 off your purchase of a mattress. If you're in the market for a mattress, it's a great one. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. You can try it for free for up to 100 days and get your money back. It's risk-free. Terms and conditions do apply. Go to casper.com/GOT and use promo code GOT to save $50 off your purchase of a mattress.
I've also got another sponsor today, and that is Sonos. And if you've been listening to the podcast this season, you've heard us talk about them a lot. That is because we think their products are awesome. They are a home audio company, home theater audio, I would say.
For music lovers.
For music lovers, right. Is that their slogan?
It's a slogan.
It sounds like a slogan, and it's a good one, and if not, maybe they should adopt it. But yeah, so basically, the way I've got mine set up, and we'll talk here in a second what you can do with this, but the way I've got mine set up, they sent me a Playbase, which is kind of the main unit. It's very much like a soundbar that connects to your TV and gives you much, much better sound, even by itself, much better sound than your TV has. Like, I didn't notice how bad my TV sounded until I got one of these things, and it just sounds night and day different. I also got shipped a subwoofer, which connects up to this thing very easily, and two what they call Play Ones, which are essentially satellite speakers, which I'm using for 5.1 setup right now. The setup is drop-dead simple. I plug in the Playbase, I download the app, and that's essentially where their quick start guide ends. Mm-hmm. And the app walks you through the rest. It's super simple. You just connect your thing to your Wi-Fi, put in your password, and it basically does the rest.
The hardest thing you got to do is enter the Wi-Fi password to your network, which if it's on the back of your AT&T router, might require you to look at a label. But you don't have to do that once because every single piece you add to it just automatically handshakes and takes care of everything.
Yeah, no, it's super simple. I was really impressed by the setup process. Now, there is another way to configure these things. That's how you've got it set up.
Yeah, I got my TV just with the bass and the sub, and then I took the satellite speakers and I sprinkled them throughout my house. Just sprinkled them.
Yeah.
There's one in the kitchen. There's one in the there's one in the bedroom. And what's cool is you can make them – you can designate zones in your house and, like, make a mesh that, like, all the speakers are on the same page playing the same thing. Or you can have the upstairs one playing music while the downstairs in the kitchen relays the audio from the TV, or you can have something playing in the kitchen while someone's watching TV. You can do it, and it's super easy with using the app. You just grab the zones and say which ones you want to add to the mesh, and then your house is rocking or everyone's listening to the same thing or something different. And they integrate into a lot of your applications. Yeah. Like it was compatible with my podcast app. I was surprised to see it was compatible with Google Play,
Spotify.
I'm assuming Spotify and iTunes, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet package.
For sure, especially for, you know, the audio lovers that we know listen to this show.
And it looks great, too. That's the other thing. Yeah. They look like black obelisks in your living room or your bedroom. And all that's the other thing is that all they need is a power cable.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to run speakers to or wire to auxiliary speakers or, you know, you can just put your sub wherever it fits.
Yep. So for the first time ever, Sonos is offering the listeners of the Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less. So you don't have to spend a crazy amount of money to take advantage of this deal. That goes for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. to take advantage of this, use the promo code GOT10. That's capital GOT10 at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer. I love the product. I think, Aaron, you also love the product. I would recommend them for anybody who's looking to upgrade their sound system.
Tyler H., I was listening to your 707 Wolf and the Dragon, or the Dragon and the Wolf cast, and you were talking about how dragons were able to take down the ice wall and how you're confused since you believe that both the ice breath or some other kind of magic beam power. To me, it just seems like he's using blue fire. In previous podcasts, you notice how the dragon fire seems to be so powerful and it acts like an explosion, not just spraying fire everywhere. In 707 cast, you also notice how the dragon seems faster and is able to use continuous fire breathing. So for me, it just seems as though being turned into a white dragon just made it stronger. As both of you know, I'm sure blue flames burn much hotter and have more energy to them than red or orange flames. To me, this seems the Double D's are suggesting the white dragon is just stronger because of this transformation.
I don't think I said we know what it is. Yeah. I think I said we don't know what it is specifically.
Right.
Like, it could be magical. It could be blue fire. It could be whatever. I'm just trying not to put a name on it because we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, blue fire beams. I mean, it does seem like...
It's clearly something that the dragon can shoot that is very powerful enough to take down a wall.
And it's consistent with the dragon essentially being on steroids.
Sure.
You know, it's faster, yeah. It screams louder, it breathes fire twice as long and twice as hot. It's Dragon 2.0.
And I'm cool with just leaving it at that. I don't need to know what it's actually shooting.
Will A declares, I'm still upset the way Bingen went out. The there's no time quote was obviously not great, Bob, considering how far away the whites were on the screen. As a first member of the Night's Watch the show introduced, and a man who has seemingly kept himself alive to save as much of the living for as long as he could, I believe there was better choices.
Sure.
For example, after saving his second nephew beyond the wall, when John says, come with me, he could have said in a resigned or even relieved tone,
fuck
my
you.
Watch has ended, and smacked a horse on the ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Sure. There again, were a thousand better things he could have said there, but...
That's a weird... That's like an A story that they did F minus execution to.
Right.
Because behind the scenes, like when they're talking about like how tired Bingen is of his unlife and how lonely it's been and how he wants a respite to his misery, like that's a hell of a plot point to talk about. And it could have been developed in his conversations with Bran and seen to fruition with John, and they just
maybe
didn't.
His there's no time is... There's no time to explain why I'm going to stand here and die.
Right. Yeah. Like, I'm
you
just
need
too
to ride.
Sick and tired of life.
Right. You can't have a convo break.
I've come out of the terminal case of the Goths, and I just want to die. So get out of here. This conversation is tedious. Bye. Michael N. The internet is furious that Theon's strength came from his amputated member, which I think would indeed be very stupid. Most are done with him, and I was right there, too. But his decision to turn things around was reinforced by Jon Aegon Targaryen Snow. His strength in that fight on the beach was evident every time he got back up. He inspired the other Ironborn, not by winning the fight, but by showing that there is no ass-kicking that he can't take and still come at you. Theon stood as a punching bag while his opponent tired himself and had to bend over, hands on his knees to catch his breath. He didn't get strength or superpower when needing the crotch. His smile at that moment was him choosing with that proximity to a tired opponent to show that he wasn't beaten. The ass kicking he got on the beach wasn't a grain of sand compared to what Ramsay did to him. There's nothing anyone can do to Theon at this point that could come close to his torture inflicted by Ramsay Bolton. That's a superpower. Unbelievable, bottomless depths of resilience. He's unbeatable now. At the hands of Ramsay, Theon is finally Ironborn. Yeah, and that's another thing that Alt-Shift-X did I thought was good, that he contrasted Theon's essentially bullshit baptism in Season 2 with this episode, where after he won, he staggered to the water and, rebaptized himself. Like, now.
Right.
And that, again, maybe the execution could have been better because, you know, what is the Ironborn's creed? Like, you know, we don't sow, and also what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger. Like, Theon was living that in the moment of that scene, which is one of the reasons I've come around to liking it. But you liked it from the beginning. I just feel like it was, I don't know. It's not a good look to have him slammed in his crotch and he just grins like an idiot.
Yeah, and to say that that is not him using his newfound superpower, I think is a little disingenuous. They knee him in the balls, non-existent balls, right. three times.
Right.
And he grins up at the guy, clearly unfazed by yeah. it. It's not because he has some mental resilience here.
Yeah.
I don't care how fucking headstrong you are. You get kneed in the crotch as a dude and you're going down.
Yeah.
If this dude the size of the mountain is kicking you in your balls.
I do think Michael Inn here is essentially providing color commentary for a better version of the scene that we watched. Because you're right. Like,
that is played in that moment for
yes.
his superpower is he has no balls.
That was played for comedy,
yeah.
which is part of the problem of the scene. I agree
with
you.
I'm coming around on it that I don't actually think it's acceptable as a scene,
yeah.
like that it's not good.
But there again, I think
in that one moment, but
yeah.
I think everything else it does for Theon's character is so worthwhile.
Yeah, no,
that it's easy to overlook that one misstep.
That's a solid A concept that the execution yeah. really because even leading up to that, the you know John's speech of forgiveness and the fact that it works equally well for Theon and John's impending discovery that he's half Targaryen, like. There's a lot of really quality, meticulous writing in there that then they decided to jettison in favor of a kick to the groin joke. And to be fair, this isn't something new. Like, mm-hmm. we have long commented on how much fun the Double D's like.
With their fart jokes.
With their fart jokes and their ball jokes and their eunuch jokes. They yep. really fucking have the mind of a 11-year-old boy writing some of this shit.
Sure. And then I think that's a tough scene to write, to convey the message that you want to convey, which is
yeah.
Theon has been through so much, and it has taught him lessons, and his conversation with Jon about not having to choose who he, you know, whether he's a Stark or a Greyjoy, he can synthesize those and become his own man. I think it's really hard to convey that without going back to his history in some way that's very, very obvious in that moment.
I mean, would it be hokey if, like, in between beatings he did, like, kind of like the Inigo Montoya chant, except for he said, like, you know, what is dead men ever die but rises, like, if he just kept mm-hmm. doing that throughout the whole fight, and it slowly kind of unnerved slash inspired Ironborn?
Maybe.
Look at me, I'm writing fan fiction again.
Yeah, I think the one thing you can't do in that scene is have him suddenly be ultra competent at fighting.
Right.
You need some way for him to get the upper hand on this guy that isn't just, he's, like... He's got his head in the right place, so he's magically an awesome fighter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't do that.
Although I that contradicts what I said, that I think they've done enough to show that Theon's a pretty good fighter, mm-hmm. that he is just traumatized and, like, paralyzed by his mm-hmm. inability to act. Now, again, like, I still, like, let's say that Jon gave his magic, you know, you don't have to choose speech between, right before Euron stormed the deck.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Theon goes at Euron, he's going to get his shit ripped in half.
Yeah, but yeah.
He's done for.
Certainly.
So that I guess that goes to the thing. It's like, this is, you know, what my credulity has limits to what Theon can accomplish just because he's been tortured to the point he don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe you could do the same thing to Tyrion, but he's not going to beat the mountain.
Right.
Like, sometimes disparities in force are just, you know, might, you know, that's why we say might doesn't make right.
Mm.
Anyway, let's see. I was Rob T says, I was listening to season 7 main cast, and you were talking about the must-have zombie polar bear and how you'd rather have seen that money go into Ghost. Don't you think it was mentioned, or I don't think you mentioned it, but what about the Double D's using a zombie summer wolf instead of the polar bear? You know, obviously Summer died tragically protecting Bran in the tree cave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, like, yes, that would have been super fucking crazy and would have disgusted a lot of people, but the Double D's wanted a fucking polar bear.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not...
I feel like it also would have set us up nicely for the white dragon.
Yeah, you're right. It's better all around.
Yeah, maybe so. But it doesn't check that box that says white polar bear.
Yeah, they wanted a fucking white polar bear.
Yeah.
That's all they asked. That and a bunch of bad pussy jokes and eunuch jokes.
Uh-huh.
Do you think... Because one of the things I said is like, hey, maybe the extra turnaround time is going to lead us to have better scripts. And then I read today that the scripts have been turned in like in early July.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little worried, man.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried. The thing I was hanging my hat on is that hat hook is gone. My hat has fallen to the floor.
I do hope that maybe they're going to take, you know, some criticisms of this season and go back and give an eye to the script. And
yet
say,
the scripts have already been written.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But can you make changes? Of fucking course you can. They haven't shot it yet. So go back, take a look at it and say, is there anything we're doing? Maybe some mistakes we're repeating.
Yeah, and that's the thing about this season is, like, it's hard to tell which points the double Ds are like, ugh, we know we're shaky on this, but we're just going to hopefully make it cool enough that people will look past it because we're dealt a bad hand. Mm-hmm. And what are things that they thought they told the story? Like, I do believe that they think that they've told the story of John mining Dragonglass sufficient that they can arm everyone in the north of Dragonglass and no one's going to bat an eye. Mm-hmm. I think they're wrong on that, but I do think, and I'll believe them on that. I think there's a couple other things like that where they just think they told, like, they thought they told the Winterfell story good enough, whereas a lot of that stuff beyond the wall, I felt like even they knew, hoo boy, this is some shaky shit.
Yeah.
We're on, so that's the thing, like, which parts of this did they know, like, we got dealt a bad hand, we're going to play it the best we can, and what was just bad ideas in there, and what they thought they did enough to tell the story, but it didn't come across.
Right.
And those are things that, who knows? And that's the latter things are the things I think they can change. Like, we told this story, but it didn't make it enough on screen. So let's make sure we get those pickup shots and let's make sure the editing comes together. And they really, we tell the best version of the story we can. Bo-Gee. My dad mentioned something interesting the other day while we were discussing the season finale. Do you think the final season of Game of Thrones season 7 is a vision of Bran's and not actually happening at the present time? How he's seen the White Walkers are going to take down the wall? Isn't Winterfell just a day's ride from the wall?
I don't believe that, but I don't really have a reason. I mean, you're asserting something.
The distance from...
And so you need to have some kind of evidence to back it up if you want me to believe it. I just see no reason to believe that that's true.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you might... Because this book ends early with, you know, the scene of the White Walkers marching south, the first glimpse we saw of a zombie white giant. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, this giant had milky white eyes, and we resolved to Bran having milky white eyes, and he's seeing, you know, he's, like, maybe warging or spying on, like, that's all tended to. But every time we've seen Bran spy on the Night King, it had the flock of crows.
Right.
So, like, that makes me suspect that other scene a lot less. And also, if they're trying to tell, that's another thing, if they're trying to tell that, like, it's they're doing it very poorly. Because I didn't get that from what they're trying to do. So I don't think it's true. I do think it's a longer march from Eastwatch to Winterfell. Like, if you want to say it's a day's ride, well, that's along the King's Road. Mm-hmm. Eastwatch is a lot, you know, there's a lot more wild and woolly terrain between that. So I'm guessing that Jon and Dany are going to be able to arrive at Winterfell just in time before the Night King besieges it.
I certainly hope so, for Winterfell's sake.
Yeah. So
Arya can't fight them all off.
But also the fact that, like, if Bran can warg into a white, which we have seen no evidence of him being able to do, displaying of that ability would be a red letter event. I don't think it's something that's like, oh, you have to really dig deep to find the meaning of the scene. It's going to be like, you know, underlined in red with an exclamation point that, oh, he can take over whites, because obviously that has a huge implication.
Right.
If he can take over undead Viserion, if he can take over any number of big, 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 high-value pieces in the Night King army, that's a bomb.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's been dropped yet. Nate S., now that Theon is chasing after Yara, do you think Cersei's Golden Company surprise will be spoiled? Well, with Theon chasing Yara, he's going to quickly figure out they're not heading to the Iron Islands, .. What do you think? Do you think Theon's going to find that Euron's heading east to Essos, and he's going to decide that he would his loyalty to Dany is going to compete with his loyalty to his sister? I could see that being interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the implications of Euron not being at the Iron Islands when Theon's headed there. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that would become quite obvious.
Right.
He shows up, no one's there, Yara's not there. I don't know. I assume somebody's manning the Iron Islands at the moment, but yeah, I just don't know where that goes.
Yeah.
I guess he would try, and he would have to try and run back. And
I mean,
tell.
You tell a compelling story. He's going to ride up with his boat full of 20 Ironborns and be like, "You're on, Bryn!" Like, there's like just no one's going to be home.
Yeah, it's going to be that Monty Python scene with the friend. Like, yeah, no.
I mean,
we're not doing it.
Like, even if there's just got to be a couple thousand Ironborn on the islands to repel Theon's little.
I would think so, yeah.
So I don't know how that's going to work. And also, like, I was convinced that Theon surviving the battle and turning Kraven with Yara was going to allow him to alert Dany the next episode that, you know, something's afoot and you're not going to get... That was going to be important, but nothing came of that. Like, to me, this feels like a little bit more intricate than of... Not from character development, from a plot mechanic, this feels a little bit more intricate than the Double D's have been doing the last few seasons. So mm-hmm. I guess I don't buy it. Hmm. Kevin C. While the episode or the finale was a much needed return to form for the show after a suspect few seasons, it's also criticized or crystallized a problem I'm increasingly having with it. The show's always tended to overrate the importance of shock value, but they seemingly are getting sloppy in their rush to finish. Tyrion and Cersei's meeting, as well as Arya and Sansa's struggle, are examples of this. They skipped a potentially more interesting but less shocking scene of Tyrion convincing Cersei so she could walk out and shock us with a change of heart. They skipped a potentially more interesting but less shocking scene of Bran telling his sisters about Littlefinger so they could shock us with him being on trial instead of Arya. They made people act out of character to get us to shocking reveals as if that's their primary goal in telling the story. I hope this is a blip, but I'm concerned the last season will follow this trend even worse. Jim, you got a thought, I can tell.
I guess I don't agree with the assessment of Tyrion and Cersei's scene. That's not what they were doing there. He didn't have to convince her. She was ready to act like she was convinced. That's not an interesting thing to convince someone who's going
right.
to act like they're convinced.
Right.
The thing that was happening there is we were being shown that Cersei is pulling one over on Tyrion, mm-hmm. which we were shown.
Yeah.
I do kind of agree that they went for shock on the Littlefinger thing, but I thought it worked.
Right. Yeah.
It really worked for me as a viewer.
Like we said, there is, you know, it's valid to frame things for the audience's enjoyment.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's cheap or dumb or it's easy, though I can see, you know, I mean, so there is a valid criticism here that Game of Thrones has never been about, or it shouldn't have been about, the giant, you know, crowd pleasing or crowd shocking moments. It's about the plot. But to be honest, the best moments of Game of Thrones have always been the shocking, jaw dropping spectacle.
Hell yeah.
Like, you know,
Ned's head coming off.
It's always been
the purple wedding.
It's been Blackwater Bay. It's been the Red Wedding. It's been the Purple Wedding. It's been the Mountain and the Viper. Like,
yeah.
I think it's highly disingenuous to say that people watch Game of Thrones because it's a tight political boiler.
It is also that.
It is also that, and that's what makes... I think the reason Game of Thrones is so successful is it tricks people that this is snooty, highbrow entertainment while still delivering big blockbuster thrills. And it does that.
Okay.
It does that fairly well. Now, it is a good question to ask, like, in the last two seasons, if there's not as much tight political potboiler and there's a lot more spectacle, will those people get turned off and stop watching? Maybe. But like I said, yeah, Game of Thrones' best moments have always been that's the reason you put up with all the stomach punches and
right.
and all the frustration, because there's no other show that makes you feel those things. So, like I said, I think there's a legit criticism that's wrapped up in some disingenuous stuff. That's unfortunately seems to be the coin of the realm on like r/ASAOAF. Sean McKay, this was a big concept or topic on Reddit about a month ago, and I think it's very interesting given John's tirade on lying in the past episode. This is long about game theory, which I think is super interesting, which was why I'm reading the whole thing. He also links to this demonstration /game. incase.me/trust, which is a way to introduce some basic game theory concepts that we've been talking about in the past podcast. One of the concepts is this, Sean continues, treating people the way they treat you, but erring on the side of caution, which in other words means treating people better when uncertainty is present, reigns supreme as a strategy in simple situations such as the prisoner's dilemma. Essentially, doing what is best for everyone until you get burned, figuratively speaking, Rickon Stark notwithstanding, and only then turning on those who have shown that they cannot be trusted is by far the best play.
Because the liars of the world eventually turn everyone against them. This is where Littlefinger's history betrayed him. Everyone in that chamber knew he was a lying little rat, and they all took, and all it took was everyone getting on the same page to close off all of his escape routes. Cersei is rapidly approaching the same point by driving Jaime away. She doesn't have anyone left that cares about her. The only loyalty she commands is those that we find that she finds useful, and possibly the Mountain, though I'd wager he's truly only loyal to Qyburn, if anyone. She's cheated and prospered, but people know they can't really trust her. John's a good example of the copycat from the link above. The only time he's ever really been dishonest was when he defected, quote-unquote, to the Wildlings, and even then he was following his orders for the good of the realm. John also saw them as untrustworthy aggressors at the time. Once he learned that they were more than that, he was willing to bring the Wildlings into the fold to do what is best for everyone. He doesn't betray people to get what he wants, but he will repay treachery with harsh punishment. He treats people as he would have them treat him. Surprisingly, Dany does a good job following that path as well. I've never been a big fan of Dany. I thought it was interesting the way she turned herself from essentially Drogo's slave to more or less his partner, but a lot of the rest of what she's accomplished has been because she was magically fireproof or has the only three dragons in the world. Nonetheless, she still uses good game theory. Miri Mazdur, the Unsullied owners, the Wise Masters, the delegates from Yunkai and Astapor, Dany never really attacked any of these people until they proved themselves to be acting in bad faith. It may have been militarily wise to have done so, but the political fallout would have been disastrous. Once she finds a ruler with a similarly trustworthy mindset, John, she finds her first real ally. Dany says she wishes John had lied to Cersei, but I don't think that's the truth. I don't think she would have lied, and I don't think she would have respected John as much if he had. Do you agree with that? I thought that was a little much when Dany says, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Like, Tyrion I bought, but Dany, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I buy that assessment of Dany, that she would have lost respect, or at least some respect, for John had he lied there.
Right. I do say that, because I've watched this episode like four or five times now, and every time I watched it, I thought that her rebuke of John got a little bit more milder. Because like, I just realized what she's really saying. It's like, all she was really saying is, boy, that decision to keep your honesty is really going to cost us a lot.
Right.
That's it. She wasn't really,
which is a statement of fact, not a judgment, really,
Yeah. And also the unspoken thing is, if you had have acted any other way, maybe long term, you know, the love boat wouldn't have happened, or like a long term political alliance might have been shakier.
Yeah.
He continues, interestingly enough, there are two other characters that strongly resemble archetypes from the link. Ned represents the always cooperate and his steadfast refusal to deceive others to benefit himself. He is summarily taken advantage of and wiped out. You also got Joffrey's, the always cheaters, who explained to his mother his philosophy of ruling in season one. He's always looking to destroy others to build himself up and found that strategy to be his downfall as well. The reality of this world is that there are very few players that have access to information and power to act on it. Honesty from those in power is super important to maintaining any kind of order. Cooperation and following the golden rule is the best long-term strategy. If only one had someone had explained the concept of proportionate response to old Walter Frey, he may have been the best follower of this concept in all of Westeros. Instead, all in all, he's just another face in Arya's wall. This whole email was just leading up to the Pink Floyd joke. God damn it. I thought that was interesting because, like, I guess I had thought the game theory had taught us that it's always best to act like the other person's trying to fuck you. And to act accordingly.
I suppose it depends on the stakes, right?
Yeah.
Because if you've one chance...
You're right.
And you lose... I mean, when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die, right? Like, those are the stakes.
Right.
And if you wait until someone screws you to play the game, then you're going to be dead before you can play the game.
It's the stakes and, like, you know, like in a geopolitical table where you're going to meet the same party again and again and again over the course of... Like, that... It seems like, it's better to assume good faith, and then if they break bad faith, then they'll eventually do that with everybody, and then you'll have a coalition that can freeze that party out and conquer them or impose sanctions on them. So
Is why we kind of had such a problem with later seasons of House of Cards.
Right.
Yeah.
Where there's very little
Frank
of...
is just, he's playing that game for himself. He's the Joffrey of that game.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just going up to everybody and grabbing them by their nuts and saying, do this thing.
Like, and breaking all his promises and telling you why he's breaking them. Like,
But that link is really cool, the incase.me/trust, if you want to know more about like basic game theory. I thought it was neat. Kim M., are we done with Dorne now?
What about Astapor, Yunkai, Marine, still technically under Danny's rule?
I assume so.
Do you think the day or the characters associated them will play in the final season, such as Dario, Alaria, presuming she hasn't died already into Black Cells? If they play no part, what do you think becomes of them? There's been little to no mention of them of late, and I wondered if it's because they're no longer relevant in the series or just another story element that should have been addressed but wasn't.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that the Dornish wouldn't be relevant to this battle up north. Even if it's just to squeeze Cersei on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, Cersei's going to squeeze the north between herself and the Night King.
Yeah.
She's going to be squeezed as well. I think that could be interesting. I just don't... So far, they haven't hinted that they're even going there.
And it's so weird because, Dorne is the anti-every other great house. Because previous to this season, which saw the destruction of, the Tyrells and whatnot, but, like, the Lannisters, the people and the soldiers had bled, but everyone on top is fine. The Dorne is an inversion of that, where, Dorne has not gotten involved. Like, their military might remains intact,
but
they've been decapitated.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, because I always think this test of, okay, well, this late in the game, how could you introduce this thing as a piece? It seems like someone smart like Jaime or Tyrion could just say what I said. Dorne is the only nation that has an intact military apparatus. Its problem is it's been decapitated. And you could tell that story in 10 seconds worth of previously ons and then bring in the shiny new eye of army to defeat the Golden Company or whatever.
Yeah.
Whether they're going to do that or not, I don't know.
You'd probably have to introduce a new leader down there, right? Because something's got to be happening down there.
Yeah.
Either it's full-on chaos and anarchy and nobody's in charge, or someone has filled the power vacuum, much more likely.
Maybe Jaime could do that, but he was a
spy.
It's
already been
land.
Done, right? Yeah. We're talking about a time span of like a year here.
Yeah.
Or maybe more, I don't know. Yeah. It has to have already happened down there, or it's just chaos, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. But if there is a loose faction that could be united by the right person, but I'm like,
yeah,
who?
Maybe.
That's the thing, could Dany do that? I don't know. That's the thing. Like, it would be weird if Dorne just sat out. But I guess I would believe that they're just in chaos and civil war down there, and they're distracted. Yeah. If we never hear from them again,
it's possible.
What's the Dorne story that needs to be told? Like, to me, Dorne has been reduced to potentially a secret weapon that someone would have. They're no longer no one we care about down there to finish an arc.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Starks, very much on the table, because they're not just a faction. They actually have people that we care about, and we want to see how they end, good or bad. But Dorne...
Howlin Reed is leading Dorne right now.
yep. Mira's going to get home to spend her final days with her family. Turns out Howlin's gone down to Dorne.
Yep.
Having a good old time. Let's see. Let's move on. Sarah. I can see where you're coming from with the idea that show Dany breaking the wheel equals some form of democracy coming to Westeros, especially since the recent secession conversation with Tyrion seems to foreshadow it. But something's been bothering me that I don't think I've heard you address, and I'm curious to know your thoughts. Dany's whole trajectory is built on her belief that she's destined to rule based on her bloodline, which is pretty much the opposite of democracy.
Yeah, she keeps saying that.
It would be one thing if she had been born into nothing and worked her way up by sheer gumption, but that's not how it happened. And aside from her saying that she wants to make things better, I haven't seen anything in her behavior suggest she stopped believing in the significance of being a Targaryen. Even the plot where Jon as a bastard could have risen up to rule on his own merits, thereby demonstrating it is a possibility for Dany, who moved in favor of dynasty by revealing he's the true-born son of a king. From our perspective, Dany couldn't choose democracy at this point without having a serious identity crisis, and there isn't time for that. How do you envision her breaking the wheel in favor of democracy or something like it without undermining the foundation of her power and self-worth?
That's very troubling, because even up till mid this season, she's been on this trip about being a Targaryen and the rightful heir and like all of these things about why she should be on the throne. And this idea of breaking the wheel seems incompatible with that idea.
Yeah, I mean, you're not... So here's the thing. I guess I never, until this season and maybe last season, saw Dany as deriving her self-worth from the fact that she's got the dragon's blood.
Right.
Because her introduction to that was her blowhard brother who was wrong about everything. Mm-hmm. She became this slave who then became, I guess, a co-equal ruler of this Khalasar. And then she had that stripped of her. And she's now this beggar walking through the desert. She got taken advantage. A very similar arc to her brother who got tricked and taken advantage of and laughed as a fool for the most of his history. And then she became slowly a power in her own right. So, like, I'm a little surprised that she's come to Westeros playing this kind of high-handed game. But to me, I guess I have no problem reading it as that's just, like, I don't know. It's like whenever two cultures meet, there's, like, this little bit of a culture clash. Like, I'm thinking when the Klingons had dinner with Kirk in Star Trek VI, like, they all have each other's worst, like, you know, stereotypes about each other. So, like, from Danny's perspective, these people are all up their own ass about their bloodlines and who has the right to rule. So I'm gonna come in and I'm going to have a stranglehold on that, because I never really got that, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you. It was sort of surprising when she starts on about all that, and I guess.
Because think of how many of her titles are about her blood and her, like, being the first of her name and right through and ruler of the Andals and the First Men, and how many of them are about the
Breaker of Chains,
Mother of Dragons. She's got a bunch more that are about, like, you know, the fact that she's freed all these oppressed people. So, like, maybe they're actually telling that through this storytelling device, that she is kind of conflicted. That there's like, you know, the mad queen inside of her, and there's the benevolent ruler, and which is going to, you know. The other way is, you know, this is not the way I want the show to go down, but the fact that, like, she does have a meltdown when it turns out that John's got the better claim and they start fighting. I mean, I said that would be my worst case scenario, but the other thing is she could just, it could be that Dany dies and, like, you know, that ends her story. Like, John then has to, like, you know, like, Tyrion convinces him that, like, you know, Dany and her best self would want to break the wheel, and here's how we do it. You know, could be that if she can't have kids, there is no way to have this, like, this you're the last Targaryen, this is the last of the line, so, you know, she has to accept the fact that she has to do something different. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious to see which way they lean going into the final season, because that's going to be, I'm willing to write it off as, like, she's posturing for the sake of, you know, displaying her power in Westeros.
Right.
But I think we need to get some kind of definitive answer. Like, her and John need to have a conversation about this or something.
Well, and the other thing that's been kind of stabilizing Dany is Tyrion. And I do think that, you know, we've talked about it in this podcast that Tyrion is on the outs with her, and you got to think when they find out that Cersei has betrayed them all, that's going to be the final straw. Like, you know, the Dany's just going to not listen to anything Tyrion has to say, and it's going to be all fire and blood with a little bit of snow from Jon. I don't know. I don't. That's the thing. Is like, I just hate I hate all those ideas.
Yeah.
The idea that her and John are going to turn against each other because of some fucking blood claim to the throne, that's just...
That's not really who he is, certainly. I mean, I didn't think it was who Dany was.
Yeah.
But she wants to do what's right by the realm, in my opinion. But, you know, when she comes down to it, is she the dragon?
Yeah.
Or is she just simply the mother of dragons?
Sometimes,
you know,
that, like, shit works, too, because I remember reading Lord of the Rings being intensely frustrated when Frodo got to the Crack of Doom and then refused to throw it in.
Yeah.
But it had earned that. Like, that's how everyone who held the ring acted. It's like this, it's this thing that corrupts you. Like, it's that's part of the plot. Like, is there something intrinsic to the Iron Throne that just, like, makes people stupid that sits on it? or gets close enough to, like, that to taste the sitting on it? Like, I don't know. I don't know that they've earned that. Although they have talked, there has been plenty of hints of her being a mad queen. I don't know. You have anything else more to say? Should we move on?
No, let's move on.
Matt S., what is the purpose of Sam's arc this year? It had to be more than just finding out about the annulment, right?
Cure Jorah.
I realize this enabled Bran to witness the wedding, but there had to be another way to do this. This poor guy cleaned all that crap up to heal Grayscale in a non-magical way and read about an annulment? Hardly worth the trip. I hope Heartsbane comes in handy at some point.
Yeah, we're still waiting for the other shoe to drop with Sam, I feel.
it is weird that they, like, I feel like him stealing all those books at the end is a way for them to cheat, because they don't have enough time to tell Sam's real, probably super complex Citadel story.
Yeah.
So essentially, he's going to steal the books that are conveniently going to have the recipe for Valyrian steel and the birth certificate of Jon Snow, proving that he was born in Hawaii and not in Kenya. And, you know. Like,
yeah, I guess I should say, I hope we're still waiting for the other shoe to drop, because it felt, man, it felt almost inevitable and a little too rote that he would come in with this piece of information that would connect John to the Targaryen line.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's because it is the easy way out and the easy thing to write for this character, or if that is just the natural conclusion of this storyline. Because it seems inevitable, right? It seems like the way it has to go.
Yeah,
and I hope I don't find myself being dissatisfied by the way things have to go, because this is the end of the story.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, like, you can look at Sam's arc, because there's a whole bunch of things in the books that are set up, characters that we never were introduced, and concepts, and, like, the fact that sand snakes are involved in a Citadel plot, if you can believe that shit. Jack and Hagar is involved in a Citadel plot, and none of that happens in the show, and it makes me... And before, whenever I've seen the Double D's condense and, like, overlap characters and, like, compress things, like, I know where they're going. I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Here, it's just, like, all I see is the resulting state of the end. So I have no idea what they've streamlined and shoehorned and compressed. Like, it does feel like Sam is pretty unsatisfying at this point.
In as much as Jon being a Targaryen is important to the story, Sam is important to the story, but Gilly equally so. Like, it's not Sam's special knowledge. It's his happenstance of Gilly reading this thing.
And it could be that Sam, like, you know, it turns out to be the author of the Song of Ice and Fire, which would make him important just, you know, in a standalone kind of way. But
is it possible he's the last maester standing at the end of it, and he's trying to carry on the work by telling the story?
Well, he never made it to maester, so...
That's true. I mean,
acolyte.
He'd be a faux maester.
I guess that's why, like, you know, arguably Luke Skywalker, Jedi Knight, declared himself a master at the end and started the Jedi Academy, which ended disastrously. So maybe there'll be a Maester Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get Kevin J. Anderson?
Yeah,
let's get Kevin J. Anderson to tell the further adventures of Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... That's the other thing, is like all this satchel of scrolls he stole, they got to be really judicious in what he pulls out, because if that's just like an ass pull for the victory on three different occasions, I'll accept the Valyrian steel recipe is in there. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Anything else, like, I mean, I obviously not, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
hot
they pies, be careful.
Bread recipe's not going to be in there.
They got to be careful what he ass pulls out of that stack of rotted bullshit. Caitlin T, why do you guys think the Dany and company didn't ask for Yara and Ilaria's freedom when negotiating with Cersei? Euron mentioned that Euron was alive.
They don't care.
let's just talk about that. So, I mean, yes, like I'm on your side, Caitlin. I felt like that wasn't nearly as interesting and as cool as it could have been, or believable as a meeting like of all these sides trying to form an alliance. Like, this wasn't Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin sitting around plotting the demise of the fucking Nazis. It was very one-sided and theatrical and all those things. So, you're asking it to be even more minutia and in-depth than it already was, and...
I guess if you mean, like, after Cersei agrees, they could say, okay, as a show of faith, give us your prisoners.
But
nobody there who, like, I'm only half joking when I say they don't care. There's nobody who gives a shit about Yara or...
Theon was there.
Theon wasn't at that. No, he was...
Yeah, he was, because Euron talked a bunch of shit to him.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, why didn't Theon stand up and say, hey, by the way, you got my sister? Could I have her back?
And Cersei could have asked for a hostage. Maybe she asked for Missandei as a hostage in return. Like, that's something that people did.
Tell him to sit down.
I don't know why it was so weird.
Yeah, you're right.
There was a lot of things in that thing that could have been better, but what are you going to do? Jimma G.,
You guys were discussing the pros and cons of not seeing a moment that Arya, or not seeing the moment, rather, that Arya and Sansa started to piece the things together and deciding to work together. And you've probably by now seen the interview with Isaac Hempstead Wright, where he revealed that there was, in fact, a deleted scene between Bran and Sansa where she essentially decided to ask him to Google a few things for her before she decided to murder her sister. I'm glad, so glad, that the Double D's decided to cut this out, as it would, in my opinion, have taken Sansa to the point where her hateful stupidity would have made her irredeemable in the hearts and minds of many fans, including myself. But I'm not sure if I can applaud them for making that decision, because why the hell did they shoot the scene in the first place? Would love to hear your thoughts on whether knowing this was shot changes your enjoyment of the denouement of the Winterfell storyline at all. It has definitely besmirched mine.
Hey, man, I would say the story is told in editing a lot of the time. And what you do include and what you don't include is where that all comes together. And shooting something is just there in case.
Yep.
Like, if all of this stuff doesn't line up quite right and we need to explain something, we can.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't have it, you don't have it, and you can't cut it together.
I was going to say the same thing. The one thing I've learned in the years of covering these shows and talking to people behind the scenes and people that know what the hell they're doing is the editing is so vital to the storytelling. And
right.
they just you never know when you're looking at the dailies and you're reading a script and you're seeing, like, well, how is this going to play? And when you put it all together and when you get the first cut, which is always, like, twice as long as it needs to be, they just start trimming to get the best storytelling, the best emotional hits. And they just keep revising that. So, like, to me, all these cut scenes, they're not, some people treat, like, the director's cut as, like, that's the real story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, that was a version of the story in some form, you know?
Well, a lot of people look at the script and say,
yeah,
this is the story. But that's not actually true. Like, the way TV and film is made, from my understanding of it, is the script is more there just for the people who are shooting the thing.
Right.
And then the story itself comes together in the edit.
Right. Yeah. So and that's where
you need to get the story filmed.
Yes.
So that the editor can, like, trim out the fat and tell the story the way it needs to be told.
Right, right. So yeah, it doesn't really change my opinion of stuff.
No, not at all. For me, anyway.
And it's weird because you can take like George Lucas is a good example because he, I've heard many times people say that the first cut of Star Wars was unwatchable garbage, and like really talented editors came in there and like looped footage and rocked footage back and forth and expanded stuff and came up with a compelling cut that kind of saved the movie. But I've also heard that, like, when he was working with Coppola in the first Godfather, like, Coppola shot that hospital scene and there was no tension to it because he just shot the things essentially that had, like, speaking roles.
Mm-hmm.
And George came in while he was editing, was like, this shit doesn't work. And George took a whole bunch of, like, the last second when someone walked off of the set. Like, there was there's one second of footage and he froze that frame and, like, all these empty shots of corridors and hallways where he just layered in this sound of footsteps and made that scene the kind of the tense thing that really works in the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, which artist is
can
George?
Can he not edit or can he edit? Like,
can he only edit stuff that other people do? And he's that's like George Lucas is an interesting guy because he's got everything that's right and wrong with all of his movies can be seen, like, all the time. But yeah, no, I don't. So long story short, I think both of us have a pretty long view of the way editing works, and I judge stuff on what actually makes it to the episode.
Right. Yeah.
That's why it drives me fucking crazy when I have someone tell me, "Well, you can't hate Batman versus Superman until you see a 3.5-hour director's cut." Like, no fucking way do I have to watch another hour of this asshole Snyder's work to appreciate it properly. Like, his homework assignment was to tell the story in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's gonna get credit for me, and he turned it in a week late with twice as much material. Fuck him. So anyway, that's the non-spoiler season. But again, the fun doesn't end here, folks. Send your feedback to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. If our season two retrospective is anything like season one, we're going to be continuing the meta discussion about Game of Thrones in the spoiler section of these upcoming season two. So we'll still continue to talk about contemporary theories and what people thought about season seven. And hopefully no one will leak the scripts until we can get done to season two, because I don't want to put up with that garbage. Although, man, I think it's going to happen again.
It's quite possible.
It seems like with the sample set that like the Game of Thrones is literally too big not to be spoiled. There's too many second language translators. There's too many subtitlers. There's too many foreign affiliates and
too many internet points at stake.
Too many internet points at stake to survive unspoiled. So, but on the other hand, how much will we really be losing if we can't speculate how the next six episodes are going? It'd be a bummer, but. Yeah. We survived this season, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're coming back next week with the first episode of season two, and we'll continue that watch until we're finished with it. Of course, things are about to pick up big time, a bold move here. If you don't want to join us with that, we've got Stranger Things coming. We're going to prime the pump with a little Stranger Things season one retrospective. We got Mr. Robot coming back. We got Walking Dead coming back. We got Westworld coming back early next year. There's so many cool things coming down the pike, plus all of our first-run Bald Movies and the commissioned podcast, all that stuff at baldmove.com. I think there's enough stuff for you guys to keep your interest until we come back somewhere between 12 and 18 months from now.
Hopefully.
Any final thoughts?
No. I don't know about you, but I'm still excited for the next season, regardless you know, this being maybe a step down from some of the best seasons of Game of Thrones.
I think this already with just a week behind, my estimation of season 7 has risen appreciably since like this time last week.
Okay.
Like as I think and mull over my minds, the big things work, and there's only like one, and it unfortunately it's a big central thing. Mm. There's only one thing that really doesn't work, and even then that was more like they still didn't quite get the execution. But when you look at, because I spent a lot of time watching all the behind the scenes because I didn't get every single one as, you know, contemporaneously. I didn't watch them all, but I sat down and watched them all over the long weekend, and they spend so much time and money.
Yeah.
Like that shot about how they got the frozen lake. Like if you think that's a stupid concept, they really went for broke trying to sell it. Mm. And like all the work that went into building that damn set and the fact that like these actors are actually out there doing it. Like, I mean, I think they're hustling their asses off. It's just, you know, an unprecedented thing to try to tell the end of a story that doesn't exist.
And it will be
for someone else to tell the story that doesn't exist. That's what's crazy about it.
It will be a bigger, if not also better thing next year. So,
yep. So we will see you then. If not, if we don't see some other time at baldmove.com, we'll see you for season 8. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.